Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpy and Peter Torpy.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. Last week on Eyes on Success, we talked with Michigan Supreme Court Justice Richard Bernstein about employment opportunities for the visually impaired.
This week, we'll talk with him about his academic and professional path to becoming a blind Supreme Court justice, including some of the challenges he's faced and accommodations he's made to be successful, as well as some of the prior work he did as a disability rights advocacy attorney. But first, for our tip of the week, this week's tip comes from Justice Bernstein.
People with disabilities, we know what we can accomplish. We know what we can achieve. Our goal is to convince the able-bodied population and able-bodied employers and able-bodied decision makers that we can do it. If simply just given the opportunity or simply just given the chance to do so.
And sometimes that's all it takes is a demonstration of success for people to believe in what can be accomplished and what you really can do.
Let's start by having Justice Bernstein reintroduce himself from last week's episode.
My name is Richard Bernstein, and I am a justice on the Michigan Supreme Court.
Most of our listeners have visual impairments. Do you?
Well, yes, I am blind.
And how much vision do you have? Are you totally blind, or you have some useful vision?
Yeah, extremely, extremely limited. And it's kind of funny that you asked the question, because that was actually the theme of my election campaign, the idea of blind justice, to allow people to become introduced to the idea of having a person who is blind serving on Michigan's highest court.
In last week's episode, we went on to explore how that related to getting employment opportunities. And in this week's episode, we will speak with Justice Bernstein about his personal experiences.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. Success, 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 success.
This week's focus topic is becoming and being a disability rights advocacy attorney and a state Supreme Court justice.
Can you describe to us a little bit about the nature of your visual impairment and when it came about?
Sure. So I was born blind. So I've always been kind of like this. I was blessed. I had wonderful public schools that I was able to attend. So the way that it worked was, you know, I went through Bloomfield Hills Public Schools. But for the most part, I spent the vast majority of my day inside the special education classroom. And that's where I was educated. Now, at certain points of the day, you know, I would come out of the special ed class environment and I would go into a general class environment, and I was able to do that because the district provided me a wonderful parapro. So I would go with, you know, my parapro into, you know, a more general class environment, and that allowed me to socialize with other students. But primarily, you know, when I was in middle school and high school and all the secondary education, what would happen was that I would basically be accompanied with a parapro at all times. So that way I was able to navigate the school, and if I wasn't in the special ed class environment, I'd be accompanied by, you know, a specially trained parapro who would allow me to go to science class or English class or history class and be able to participate in a social environment and social structure with all the other students. And then I would usually return back to the special ed classroom where I'd be able to have kind of the one-on-one teaching and educational instruction that was absolutely required for me to have the chance to be in public schools.
That would be mostly Braille literacy skills, I would imagine?
We would do that, and then we would also couple that with technology, and then we would also couple that with use of readers as well to be able to be effective.
So then when you went to college or university, you probably didn't have a paraprofessional following you around campus. What kind of accommodations did you require then?
Well, actually, I did. You know, I did have an amanuensis when I was in college, and that was absolutely critical for me. In fact, I had an amanuensis when I was in college, and then I had the same amanuensis join me in law school. And again, that's why I am so impassioned on these issues and trying to help disabled people, because a lot of this is financial resources. I mean, look, we both know 85% of the blind population is currently unemployed. That's not because blind people aren't hardworking or aren't impassioned or, you know, wouldn't do an amazing job. It's socioeconomic. You know, I was just very blessed. I was born into a family that had financial resources to allow for me to have the best of education, the best of schools, and we were able to hire, you know, a full-time person that was able to assist me in college as well as assist me in law school.
Is that something that you personally had to provide, or is that provided by the state or government?
So it depends on each individual state. It depends on each individual commission. And in many situations, it will be dependent based off each individual university that you might be attending as it pertains to the level and structure and support they're willing to provide. Mm-hmm. In my situation, it was a decision that my family made, which was that we were going to do this at our own expense. And that's why I care so deeply about this, is going back to what we were talking about before, that 85% unemployment rate, again, that's socioeconomic. I mean, the only reason I'm a Supreme Court justice, the only reason that I'm an attorney, the only reason that I'm able to do the kind of things that I'm able to do is because I came from a family that had the financial resources and financial ability to give me the kind of blessings that I've been able to have. And so I'm very, very sensitive to that. And so for me, the reason that I'm so dedicated to this cause and dedicated to this issue is that I am very, very much aware of the fact that if I didn't have the family background and the financial resources that I was so incredibly blessed with, I don't believe there's any question that I would be part of the 85% of the unemployment rate that currently exists. I want to do anything and everything I can to try to equal out the playing field for others who haven't been given the same level of opportunity that I've been given.
When you went through college and law school, there's a lot of reading involved in these areas, of course.
Yes.
And I was wondering, how easy was it for you to acquire your textbooks in either an electronic format or Braille, or did you have to have someone read them to you?
So that it's different now than it was today. I mean, I did this literally like 16 years ago. So, you know, I think that it was a whole different situation than it is now. I mean, that's why I used an amanuensis when I was in law school, because it wasn't as effective or efficient as things are currently today. So I think it's the whole brave new world that we've entered in today, where technology just is so expansive and so limitless as it pertains to what's available or what's out there. Now, having said that, the way that it worked for me when I was in law school was I would literally memorize and internalize everything that the professor was saying. So I would literally commit everything to memory. And, you know, that was a really brutal process. And going through law school for me was exceptionally challenging because, you know, you'd get a contracts question or a property question, and your contracts question would be like a 15-page fact pattern. And I would literally memorize that entire fact pattern, word for word, and then dictate to a scribe what my answer was. But they would literally read that fact pattern to me, you know, 15 to 20 times, so that I could internalize it and memorize it. Then only after memorizing that fact pattern would I begin to attempt to start answering the question that was presented by the exam. The challenge was so great, just in terms of the fact that it took me 5 times longer to do something that it would take an able-bodied student. So it was just, I went to school year-round for 3 years.
I assume the faculty was willing to give you extra time on the exams because they understood that you needed the extra time to handle all of the question and background material?
Absolutely. And you could not have found a better school for me to go to. I mean, Northwestern was incredible. So they made the, you know, appropriate accommodations. But really what Northwestern was so good at, Northwestern was just a great school. Northwestern didn't really use time as a relevant component in any of their exams. It was just a very progressive, wonderful school. So you know, the standard would be if there was a time restriction, Northwestern would give me like 5 times. But really that wasn't even a factor because Northwestern developed an entirely new policy that basically said that there was no time restriction, that we had self-scheduled exams, that literally students could just take exams whenever they wanted. Everything was on the honor system, and you could take as long as you wanted with the exam, and you could take the exam whenever you wanted to take it during the exam period. Northwestern was just so progressive and so great to their students that Northwestern took the perspective of, you don't come and take your exam at 10 o'clock on Tuesday morning. You have exam periods. You have, say, you have 4 exams. Pick them up from the registrar's office. Take them whenever you want. You can take them home. You can do whatever you want with them. You can take as much time as you want with them. And it was, as long as you did it within the exam period, you were completely free to take the exam whenever you want and put whatever time into the exam that you wanted to put into it.
I guess in contrast, when you went to law school, a lot of this documentation, contracts, et cetera, are available electronically to you. What other accommodations do you use in your current job to access material and interact with what you need to interact with?
So for me, like, I find that the way I work as a justice is I need to use readers, and I actually just use clerks. The way it works for me is I have an additional clerk. So the other Supreme Court justices have 4 clerks. I have a 5th clerk. And so my 5th clerk basically functions in the role of communicating to me all the bench memos, working with me to kind of go through making all the necessary changes, all the various edits to the memos and to the materials, and helps me write and craft the decisions and opinions that we have to write. So for a justice, for me, it's really essential just to have that additional person. And the reason why is that adaptive tech works great in most areas, but it won't really work well in this situation because I like to call it active reading. And where you have active reading, you're doing like 5 different things. You'll have the appellant's argument, the appellee's argument, a bench memo, the Constitution in front of you, the Court of Appeals decision, the legislative history, the procedural history in front of you. You may have like 7 different documents in front of you at one time, and you literally have to go from one to the other to the other to the other. I mean, so the challenge with adaptive technology is that if you've got like 7 or 8 documents that you're referring to at one time, you need someone to have to kind of go back and forth through all of those documents, as well as memorialize all those documents to allow for you to be able to express to your other clerks how you want them to write and what you want them to focus on and what you want your voice to be as it pertains to how the opinion should come out.
That's a very different mode of operation than just reading through a document, you know, having to scan back and forth like that.
Right, but, you know, it would sound up front like this clerk who's being your reader is just doing grunt work, but that clerk is probably learning more about how you function and how you think about what you're hearing and reading than any of the other clerks.
So that's a wonderful question, and it's an incredibly competitive clerkship position. And the reason for that is exactly right. Most clerks are limited to 2 or 3 cases, and that's it. They get assigned 2 or 3 cases. They know those cases, and they communicate with you primarily through bench memos, you know, and they communicate with you through memoranda. I mean, that's primarily kind of how they will communicate with you. This clerkship is a very unique one because I don't think there's any other clerkship in the country where the clerk gets to have this much direct contact with an individual justice, where they're literally spending this much time with the judge, going back and forth with the judge. You know, in a lot of ways, I mean, they're playing a really significant role because you're asking them, well, what do you think about this? And what do you think about that? And tell me to and go and find this and go and find that. So their level of interaction with the individual judge, which would be me, there's nothing else like it anywhere else in the country. So the level of interaction they get to have in this clerkship far surpasses any other opportunity they would have in any other clerk-related role. And what we usually do is what we're doing is, you know, the clerk that is actually doing this kind of a work, what they will do is they'll do this for 1 year, And then after they finish this job, they will then move into your more traditional clerkship role, where they would do your traditional drafting and opinion writing and all that kind of stuff. So this is a unique clerkship. It is a unique opportunity. It's a unique challenge. But the exposure is unlike anything that a traditional clerk would have.
Besides the extra clerk, do you have any other accommodations that you use?
So just giving an example, I like to give concrete examples so that, you know, it's helpful for employers to kind of see positive, concrete kind of message that comes out of it. So just an example of kind of an accommodation that I have at the Supreme Court that has actually worked out well for all the other justices. The way that I have to function as a Supreme Court justice is I have to memorize and internalize everything. So when a case comes up to the Supreme Court, I've literally internalized it backwards and forwards. So I know that case and every facet of that case, and I do it from memorization, so it's a lot of repetition. So what we do is at the Supreme Court, when we have oral arguments, we usually have 2 days a month or 3 days a month that we do oral argument. It's like 10 cases. So that's relatively straightforward because I memorize all of those 10 cases. And then I'm able to engage the attorneys that are coming before the court, you know, in an elaborate discussion as it pertains to all of these different cases. And I've done it so that I've memorized at such a level that I can engage in that kind of a conversation, in that kind of a discussion with the counsel as they make their arguments. Now, where it gets really challenging is we also do something called conference. So conference is where all the justices come together and we vote while we're in conference on what cases we're going to grant leave to take up to the Supreme Court. So we basically go into conference and then all seven justices sit around a table and then we determine while we're in conference, okay, which cases are then going to come up to the Supreme Court. So what we have to do is there's usually an average of 26 cases on the conference agenda. That's a lot of cases. So you usually have, let's say, 26 cases on the conference agenda. You might have seven opinions on the opinion agenda, and then you might have eight administrative items on the ADM agenda.
That's a lot to keep in your head.
It is a lot that you have to memorize. So how does it work as an accommodation? So what we do is one of the commissioners will read out loud the procedural history of each case. So they'll read, you know, case 17. Here is the procedural history of this case. When I hear the procedural history of the case, that is kind of my mental trigger within my memory and my mind, everything I need to know about that case. And it's a simple accommodation. It takes a little bit longer. Because, like I say, instead of just going right to the case, the commissioner does, you know, the procedural history. They do a reading of the procedure. They do a fact-based, specific analysis of the case coupled with the procedure. And then once the commissioner reads that procedural history out loud, I then know everything I need to know about that case. So that's an accommodation that's done for me so that I can participate on an equal footing with all the other justices. But what's really interesting is that all the other justices love this accommodation because, number one, it gives them a chance to catch their breath. It gives them a chance to kind of, you know, hear the case. And everyone has trouble keeping the cases from getting confused. So when you have a procedural history that's read out loud, what everyone at the court will say is, it doesn't just make it better for me. It made the conference more effective and more efficient for everyone. And what you will hear from all the other justices, that this is accommodation that really has made the conference process work even better for them.
And I think that's true in many areas. Often I find if things are made more accessible for me in terms of how I use a particular product or a website, it's often easier and more pleasant for people who are not visually impaired. It happens very often that making something accessible and easy to navigate and use for visually impaired folks often make the experience more pleasant for sighted folks.
Well, I can tell you in every case that I've ever tried, so that's always been my passion is, you know, fighting for the rights of people with disabilities and special needs in order to give them a better life. It's been my entire life's passion, And for all intents and purposes, this is what I've dedicated my, you know, pretty much my entire life to doing. And what I will tell you in every single case, you know, whether, and I'll use the University of Michigan as an example. So, you know, before I went onto the bench, you know, I used to be an adjunct professor at the University of Michigan. And the University of Michigan was spending, I think it was like $350 million to renovate the stadium, the football stadium. But they weren't going to make it accessible for people with disabilities. And back when I was in private practice, I was the attorney for the Paralyzed Veterans of America, the PVA. And it was their goal to make the stadium accessible for wheelchair-using veterans. It was our objective to make the stadium accessible for all people. Now, this case went on for about 5 years in federal court, arguing over the accessibility of Michigan Stadium. Now, a perfect example of this is that after we fought with the university for 5 years to get them to make the stadium accessible for all people with disabilities, it was quite remarkable. What happened was basically they rebuilt the stadium. Now the stadium is beautiful, totally accessible. You have all new concourses. You have all new parking lots. You have all new concession areas. You have all new restroom facilities. The entire facility is now completely accessible for people with disabilities. But what did the university learn by restructuring their facility to make it accessible for the disabled? They found that senior citizens love the facility. And what they also found was, you know, when we first started the case, they used to make the argument that, why are you making us do this? You know, who's going to come? Who's going to use it? You're going to make us make this facility totally accessible for disabled people, but what's the point? Because disabled people aren't even going to come to use it. Well, what they found was that making it accessible for disabled made it a better facility for everyone, increased their market share, and just a point of note that I thought was very interesting was that during the time that the University of Michigan was performing horribly in terms of they had the worst football season you could imagine, it was the disabled seating that was sold out. And it was the disabled customers and disabled fan base that was coming no matter what to come and experience a Michigan football game. I will tell you in every single case that I have had that it always starts off the same way. It always starts off with a big fight where they say, why are you making us go through all this? Why are you making us do this? It's such a waste of time. It's such a waste of energy, and it's going to go unused. Every single case that I have had after we've been in litigation for a number of years, they usually come to me and they say, you know what? We can make this even better because we now realize that this is going to increase our market share and make it better for everyone.
You said that this is common in many of the cases you've worked on. Can you describe another example that would fit this pattern?
Huge fight with Delta Airlines and the Metropolitan Detroit Airport Authority to make aviation accessible for people with disabilities. What did they find? What happened as a result of this federal litigation? What they ultimately found was that it not only did it make it better for people with disabilities and special needs, but it allowed for better customer service for all people using the kiosk, getting to the gates, all the different elements that went into this case that were designed exclusively for accessibility, made it better, made it safer, made it easier for all people, not just disabled people. And I can tell you in every case that I have been a party to, that I've been a part of, the exact same result that has come from every one of those situations.
Funny how we can sometimes expend so much energy trying not to solve the problem where we could expend less energy actually just getting in there and fixing the problem.
And as we talked with Justice Bernstein, he described a few other examples, but we've got limited time on this show, so we're going to cut it off here. Now for this week's final item, one of the hardest parts of Justice Bernstein's career path, and it may surprise you to find out what that was.
And I know we both have to run, but I just want to make one other really quick point about the LSAT. And I think this is a really important thing that your listeners should be aware of. when people are going to law school, they're required to take the LSAT, the Law School Admissions Test. And I just think it's important to point out what a discriminatory exam that is, and that people who are blind or visually impaired should not see that exam as being predictive of how they're going to perform in law school or as a lawyer. And the reason that I think it's important is because on the LSAT, you have a section called Logical Games. And in the Logical Games section, it's going to ask you a question like this. A, B, C, D, E, and F go to a dinner party. If A is seated next to C and B is next to D, where is F in relation to A if C is next to B? And it literally says on the exam that you are required to diagram the answer in the space provided in order to fulfill the requirements of the exam. And what's really unfair is that blind people obviously can't do it. And even if you were to take the exam in Braille, even if you took the exam on tape, and even if you were to take the exam with unlimited time, it doesn't change the fact that it's a visually biased exam and incredibly challenging, if not without question discriminatory, for blind people to perform on it. And I just think that this is without question one of the saddest things that has hit the disabled and blind community is the requirement of the LSAT, a visually biased exam, on people who are blind or visually impaired, who want to go to law school, who, upon going to law school, will not be required to use any of the skill sets that are being tested in an exam that is not designed or created for blind or visually impaired people to be able to perform in a equal manner to those who have sight. I just wanted to make that point clear. So thank you so much for this interview, and thank you for giving us a chance to talk to you. If you have any other questions, please don't hesitate to reach out and contact us.
Okay,
well, thank you so much.
And in our show notes for this week's show, we'll have some links to some articles about the judge and some websites where you can learn more about his experiences. Just go to www.eyesonsuccess.net and take advantage of those show notes.
That's it for show number 1526. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking about the Blaze series of multi-reader products from HIMSS International. And we'll be speaking with Dave Wilkinson about these powerful products that you can use for reading EPUB material. And they even have OCR built in. They have recording capabilities. They're very versatile, and Dave will give us a demonstration of how they work. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-258-0333.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey, and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. For detailed information or a full archive of programs, visit www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also follow us on Facebook and on audioboom.com at Eyes on Success, or Twitter at @_EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success, and have a nice day.